Witam państwa serdecznie, to kolejny zwykła.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. This is yet another lecture at our festival, the Jewish Culture Festival, and at the same time this is the second lecture delivered by Professor Dan Behat from Jerusalem. I believe you have already heard me speaking about Professor Behat, so I don't need to repeat that now, and I'd like to invite Professor to the floor to continue his story about Jerusalem. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Dan Behat.
Dziękuję bardzo. Niestety, ja muszę siedzieć.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, I have to stay seated and I have to keep using my computer. And as I have already said, as I said yesterday, I would love to give this lecture in Polish, but unfortunately my Polish is not good enough to deliver a lecture in it. This is why the lecture will be in English, but I understand everything in Polish, so you can address me in Polish, you can ask me questions in Polish. So this is my second lecture. I will focus on the history of the temple, of the Temple Mount.
I will try to speak slowly so the gentleman and the lady who are translating will have enough time to translate what I say. The first picture which I brought can show you the Temple Mount, where you can see the two holy shrines to the Muslims, the Dome of the Rock with its golden rock, golden dome, and down below the Aqsa Mosque. I show it only, this is the situation how the Temple Mount, as it was built by Herod the Great, you can see the walls of the Temple Mount on three sides here. To the right, in this part, it is beyond the picture, but not far. I start only since I know that I am in a Christian country, and I think that it will be very interesting for you to know that what you see here is a Muslim copy of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Svante Grub, that was built by Constantine the Great. This church was built, it comprised three important parts. First of all, the rotunda, in the middle of which was the tomb of Jesus. Then the holy garden, where the hill of Golgotha was. And finally, here he was in the church, was the basilica, where people were praying. In other words, all what you see here is actually the Temple Mount as it was, as it looks today, but as it was constructed in the 8th century AD by the Umayyad caliphs of the Muslims. And since they were just coming from the deserts of Arabia, they did not know how to build. And the works of the constructions were made by Christians who lived in Jerusalem, and we've got even a story that one bishop was an expert in working in marble, and he was the one to cover the marble under the Dome of the Rock, and the Patriarch of Jerusalem told him, you are doing abomination, you are doing the wrong things, billing for the Muslims, and you should stop. So we know that even one, at least one name of a Christian builder we know. So that's a very interesting thing. Now, as a general thing, so this was just to show to you the continuity of things in Jerusalem. Something which was completely Christian, suddenly you see its, I would say, transfiguration into a Muslim structure. On the left-hand side, you can see the Western Wall, which is here, which all of you know, one-ninth of it here. This is the Wailing Wall, where the Jewish people are praying today, where, because of reasons which I'll speak later, this will be one of the topics of my lecture today, religious people, because they don't want to desecrate the holy Temple Mount, refrain from going up to the mountain. You'll never see ultra-Orthodox walking around here. They are happy with the possibility to pray here against the Western Wall built by Herod the Great to the Temple Mount. Now, the interesting thing is that in the 19th century, I repeat it, some of you have been yesterday in my lecture, we'll see some of the picture because I speak about the same city. So the possibility is that I will repeat some of the slides. Now, this is actually a map of the Temple Mount, but not of the Temple Mount itself, but the rock under the Temple Mount. This we know thanks to a British archaeologist whose name was Sir Charles Warren, who worked in Jerusalem between 1867 and 1870, and he, on the Temple Mount, as long as he could before he was ejected, he could dig everywhere, excavated pits going down to the rock, and what you see here is a result of his work. Those of you who can read, you see that everything is written in German, is because of a simple reason. Actually, everything which we have is in English, but Charles Warren wrote everything in feet, above sea level, feet and inches. So a German scholar in 1908, he decided to make all of Warren's work to change it into meters. And that's why we've got here, all the measurements are in meters. Between the summit of the hill is 744 meters above sea level. The important thing for us is that when you see the entire enclosure of the Herodian Temple Mount, you can see here that actually it covers valleys, like a valley which runs here, another valley which goes down here, another valley which goes down here. Some places the mountain was cut, and rock is visible. By the way, today I had the opportunity, which I suggest to many of you. This rock, which I show here, is not visible today. It is all covered with earth. But in the framework of the festival, the Dominican Fathers make an exhibition where they show Jerusalem as it was photographed by the Dominicans. It was already in the beginning of the 20th century and even before. And one picture, which I was very much excited to see, shows this rock which you can never see otherwise. I suggest very much to see it is in the cloisters of the Dominican monastery, a fantastic exhibition which for me was a great thing to do. And there you can see very well this piece of rock. The result of the works of Warren, we have here Mount Moriah. You see that here is a kind of a mountain which has depression here, but altogether it is a beautifully shaped hill, which is Mount Moriah. Yesterday I've explained that Mount Moriah comes from the word foundation, and the summit of the mountain is the holy rock, which is sheltered by the Dome of the Rock, the mosque with the golden dome. This is the summit, 744 meters above sea level. So this is what it is. In Judaism, the higher, the holier. And so, actually, we can say that on that rock was the Holy of Holies of the Temple. And this is a basic thing in order to understand the story of the mountain and the temple on it, as we will see in the next pictures which we have. This is in Hebrew. I'm afraid not many will understand. But this is a copy, actually, or not a copy. This is an idea which was suggested by an Israeli archaeologist many years ago. And to this very day, it did not change. We all believe that more or less he is right in what he has done here. What you can see here is Mount Moriah, exactly what I've shown you in the previous picture. I'm going back for a minute. You can see what it shows is this hill here. And, of course, here is the temple. You see? Because this is the highest of all. So now, going back to the picture, you can see, what can we see here? The hill itself. You see, I'm not so sure that it is as steep as it goes down here, but definitely it is a well-defined hill. On top of it, this is the temple, and usually we know that all the temples in the ancient Near East, including the description of the Temple of Solomon, which we have in the Book of Kings, the temple itself was divided into three parts, the hall, the entrance hall, the hall, and the Holy of Holies, which is here. If you think about it, all the temples which you have seen, if you traveled in Italy and Greece, when you have seen the Greco-Roman temples, they always look east, which is here, and the holiest part of it is in the west. So the temple in Jerusalem was not any different. When you read the Book of Kings, which is very interesting to see, and you don't notice it when you read it, that after the description of the construction of the temple, immediately there is a description of the royal palace of King Solomon. And when you read the dimensions of both, you see that actually, although the description in the Book of Kings is very much detailed about the temple, it is less detailed about the palace. But when it gives the dimensions, you see that it was an enormous complex, which you see here. You see, the complex is like this. I would like to remind you that in antiquity, or in the East rather, the royal palaces were not like you have in Europe. When I say about the royal palace in Britain, it will be the Buckingham, it will be Versailles, even the Wawel here in Krakow. These are solid buildings which are palaces. But in the Orient, palaces, royal palaces, are made of pavilions. I don't know if somebody has been. The best example and the closest example I can give you is the Alhambra in Granada. Those who have been there may recall that it is comprising of pavilions, pavilions, pavilions. That's how it is. This is the typical Oriental way by which also the royal palace of King Solomon was. I do not want to neglect the fact that before King Solomon, the beginning of the Jewish history of the Temple Mount is with King David, who built an altar on the summit of Mount Moriah, a place which will later will be the site of the temple in Jerusalem. Now, in this picture, the only question which I ask about it, because generally it can be expected, expected, you can see that somehow he describes here as if the rock was cut in order to create an enclosure, a precinct, a closed place in the center of which is the temple. This is a very intriguing question to ask, and soon you'll see that really it is one of the basic problems of understanding the story which I'm telling you now. Here you can see what is always suggested by all the people, all the scholars who tried to know what the shape of the Temple of Solomon was. This, from all the suggestions, I've chosen this one as the most realistic I can imagine. You can see the entrance from the east. There are two columns which are freestanding, which are named Yakin and Boaz, mentioned Yakin and Boaz, mentioned in the Book of Kings of importance. They were not made of stone, they were made of bronze, which gives it a kind of a mystery, because we don't know who was Yakin and who was Boaz, and why they are named that way. By few steps, as always, because remember I've said, the higher the holier, we go into the first courtyard, or first rather room, probably covered, but from here you enter the main hall of the structure. Inside we've got the Holy of Holies, which was very interesting. It was all built of wood, and you can imagine inside the building, from all sides it was covered by wood, floor, ceiling and the walls around. All of them made by the cedar of this, the wood was the cedar of Lebanon, which became so famous that to this very day, for Lebanon, from the touristic point of view, the cedars of Lebanon are some of the highlights of the visit to Lebanon, although not too much was left. Around it, you can see all kind of rooms around. They are also of great importance. Why? Already we know from the first temple period to the second temple period, we always hear that the priest had to go up to the roof. Very important factor in the history of the temple. Why? They had to go to the roof to see the birth of the moon, because the Jewish calendar is the lunar, and therefore the priest had to decide when the moon is coming out to know this is the beginning of the month. And I want to tell you, the right of the priest of Jerusalem to decide when the month starts is such an important factor that they insisted on keeping it for centuries, not for centuries, for millennia. And only now, later in Babylon, when Jewish population of Jerusalem dwindled, only then some of the priests in Iraq of today, of Mesopotamia, took it on themselves, and there was a real conflict between the priests in Jerusalem and the heads of the community in Mesopotamia, who has got the right to declare the beginning of the month. I want to tell you that we who live in Jerusalem with the Arabs, there who maintain to this very day the lunar month, always when there is a time, the beginning of the Ramadan or the end of the Ramadan, only about a day or two before the holiday, we know when it starts. When you ask an Arab, when is Ramadan starting? He says, I don't know. It can be Monday, it can be Tuesday, it can be Wednesday. Because only then, very close, they decide. And of course, this is a mess to a modern society. It is a real mess to know when things should stop and when things should start and so on and so forth. So you understand that going up to the roof by this series of rooms upstairs was of great, great importance in Jerusalem. This is an aerial photograph which I made of a model which I made myself in the Museum of the Biblical Lands in Jerusalem. I mentioned it yesterday, 1996. We said that Jerusalem, this is exactly 3,000 years that King David declared Jerusalem the capital of Israel. And for that, we made an exhibition of all the capital cities of the ancient world, of the Egyptians, of the Hittites, of the Assyrians, of the Babylonians, and of course, Jerusalem. This came out to be very successful, and this model is still exhibited there. What can I see here? In the beginning, you can see here the temple, and you see we made the city wall here according to the topography to leave Mount Moriah all inside. And here you can see the temple, and immediately to the south of it, you can see all the pavilions which make the royal palace, including here on the left, the Citadel of David, where King David lived. We know that King Solomon, when he built his complex, all of David's family left the Citadel of Zion, as it is called in the city of David, and moved to the palaces. Now, a very significant thing, which you can see here, you'll see that here we have, I made here walls as with a gate, as if the temple was standing in an enclosure, a big courtyard which was bordered. The interesting thing is what I did, as you can see, this wall and this wall, two of them are 250 meters exactly. Why did I do that? Because in the book of Ezekiel, when he describes the temple, I'll come to it, he tells us that the temple had a courtyard or temple mount, which was 500 cubits on 500 cubits. A cubit in the all through our history almost was about half a meter. So therefore I say 250 on 250. This is something very significant, as you'll soon see. And therefore, since we don't know if it was really already from the first temple that already King Solomon made an enclosure of 500 cubits on 500 cubits, therefore I did only two walls, and this one I did different, so that no one come and accuse me for deciding that the 500 cubits on 500 cubits was already in the first temple. The beauty of the temple was undoubtedly of great importance also, because all the stories which we have about it is very much inflated to show the beauty of the temple. What is the story is that immediately, short time after the death of King Solomon, who built the temple more or less 960 BC, short time afterwards, in 925, there was the first Egyptian invasion by a king called Shishak in the Bible, or Sheshonk in Greek, and he stripped off all the gold and the beauty of the temple, and he took it as spoils to Egypt. But the interesting thing is that pretty soon, all through the first temple period, more and more the temple was embellished, and in the memory of the people who lived in Jerusalem, the temple was the most beautiful building in the world. That's how they saw it. So we have to attribute great importance to the fact that indeed the temple was of great beauty, one way or the other. Now, this is the way the temple looks. You can see down below completely empty area, and again you can see here the two walls, which are 250 on 250 meters. For the moment, it is not important to you. And you say, why does he mention the 500 cubits so many times? For that, you'll see that the importance of those 500 cubits on 500 cubits is important to Orthodox Jews to this very day. It is amazing that this is a phenomenon of 3,000 years, which is still of great importance. Now, what I bring here is a very interesting thing. This is a plan of the temple as described by Ezekiel. First of all, you can see it is a square. You see about 500 cubits on 500 cubits. And you can see gates to three sides on both sides. This is exactly what Ezekiel says. And of course, the temple inside. You go to, this is an outer court, inner court, and the temple again, the altar, the steps leading to the three parts of the temple. So you see the principles which I've just mentioned are applicable to the description of Ezekiel. Very interesting, because again it is the 500 cubits on 500 cubits is effective. What I bring here to show you is that how much we can rely on the descriptions of in the description in the Bible. You know that in 538, you see the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in 586. In 538, the emperor of Persia, the king of Persia, Cyrus, he declared the liberty of people, and the Bible, yes, in the book of Esdras, he says exactly what he said to himself. God has shown me what to do, and every nation back to its country to build its temple and so on. Here, what we see in the picture is a prism which was found in Babylon, and it shows exactly the same text in cuneiform writing, and this is the declaration of Cyrus. The only difference is that whereas in the Old Testament it speaks that God has shown me the way, in the prism we say the God Merodach, the most important god of Babylon, from which the Hebrew name Mordechai to people comes, Merodach has told me, instructed me to give liberty to all the people and so on. So you see the text is exactly the same. So the writer of the book of Ezra, really, as if he saw this one and only changed the name of the deity, of the god who is mentioned in the text. To sum up the first temple, I bring here a map which I did for an atlas of Jerusalem. In this case, it is the Italian, so that's why those who can read Italian can see it. You see the temple in the center, on top of Mount Moriah, which is visible, Mount Moriah. The city walls are following the line of the topography. Then we've got the city itself. Today it is called the hill of the city of David, and down below the pool of Siloam as we know it today. After the excavations, we know exactly where it was, what its shape was, and so on. What you can see here is actually Jerusalem in the first temple period in the days of King David. Not a big city, but you can see that when King Solomon builds the temple and encircles the temple with wall, he actually doubles the size of Jerusalem, which is slowly, slowly becoming more and more important. And now I go to the story, which is very, very complicated, and I do it very slowly so the translators will understand. Today, people who want to see the temple, they speak about the third temple. They want to see the third temple being built. That is what they say. The first temple, of course, was the temple built by King Solomon. The second temple built by the repatriates from Babylon, those who came from Babylon. And we know from the book of Ezra who were the builders. One of them was named Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and the other one was Yehoshua, which is, by the way, Jesus, Yehoshua, it's the son of Yehotzadak. So the two people who build the temple, they will also play an importance in what I'm telling you now. Okay, they build a temple. The important thing is that all the elders who still remember the earlier temple cried and wept when they saw the substitute, because it was so poor and so unlike. You remember I told you that the temple of Solomon, the vision of the people, was the most beautiful, great temple. And suddenly a substitute which is poor, of poor people who are doing that. Very interesting. Now I stop for a minute just to go and explain something very interesting. You know that we have today problems in the international organizations like UNESCO. UNESCO denies the fact that the Jews have any connection to Jerusalem, and so also they are encouraged by the Arabs, say that all the temples and all the stories of the temple are all not true. In the 20s, the great Mufti of Jerusalem, many of you might have heard about him. He was a terrible person, a fascist of the worst. During the World War II, he was with Hitler in Berlin all through the year. He organized Muslim army to the Gestapo, really a terrible person. But when he was in Jerusalem, he published on behalf of the Muslim authorities, he published a guide to the Temple Mount. And there he writes as follows. When he describes the Dome of the Rock, you remember the mosque which has the golden dome, he says, on this spot stood the first temple built by Solomon, destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, and the second temple built by Herod, destroyed by Titus the Roman. That's what he says. After the Six-Day War, and even recently again, the Muslim authorities in Jerusalem say, some people say, and I quote exactly, you won't believe it, some people say that here stood the temple built by King Solomon, Solomon destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, and the temple built by Herod destroyed by the Romans. But there is no proof to it and no proof to the existence of the temple on that spot. You see, this is the difference between this terrible person, this fascist at first, who had to admit the existence of the temple, and today the Palestinian says no one has seen it, so it did not exist. You see, very important to mention it. Why do I mention it? Because both are wrong. Already you see that the first temple, we all agreed, built by King Solomon, destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. The second temple, built by the patriots from Babylon, and we have got even the names of the builders, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Yeshua, the son of Jehozadak. So we know already there is a second temple. So what is going next? So if we speak about Herod building the temple, what temple will it be? It will be already the third temple, right? Destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. So already you see that the history, as is described, is already falsified. And I'm going further on. You see, the second temple was built in 515 BC. 515 BC, which means the Temple Mount in Jerusalem was without a temple from 586 Nebuchadnezzar to 515 when the new temple was built. It's exactly, I will say, almost exactly 70 years. All right, very nice. Now, not too long time comes Alexander the Great. Our country was conquered by Alexander the Great in the year 333 BC. Very easy to remember. And you know that 1 year later, in 332 BC, Alexander founded Alexandria. Pretty soon, Alexandria becomes a world cultural center. It inherits Athens or the other important Greek city for the culture of the time. And Alexandria, the population of Alexandria, are the greatest artists. This is what we call the Hellenistic period, not the Hellenic period, rather than the Hellenistic period. And Alexandria takes a very important part. Amongst other people who settled in Alexandria were the Jews. As I mentioned yesterday, after repatriation from Babylon, the people who are called Israelites and Hebrews and so on are called Jews because they comprise the greater part of the population come from the tribe of Judah. So actually Jews, as you know, or Zid in Polish, will come from the word of the name of Judah. So that's what we have. Now, the Jews made an important part in the cultural life of Alexandria, and many of the books which you know, either from the Christian Bible or from the Apocrypha, were written in Alexandria starting from the 3rd century BC, from around 300, and they comprise a very important part in the literature, like the Book of Judith, for example, the Book of the Jubilees, and many, many books which you know from the Christian Bible, which are, for us, the Jewish people, they are the Apocrypha, like the Book of Maccabees and others, whereas in the Christian Bible, they are included in the Bible. At any rate, the interesting thing, that amongst other things, we have got the two books. One of them is very important historically. It is named the Letter of Aristeas. Who is Aristeas? Aristeas was a minister in the court of one of the Egyptian kings, Ptolemaeus II, whose title was Philadelphos. That was his name. Talmai Philadelphos, the king, was of great, cultural importance, and he decided that he wants to understand what the Hebrew Bible is about. So he sends Aristeas to Jerusalem to look for 70 sages, 70 rabbis, who will translate for him the Bible. And this is what we call Septuagint, which many of you who deal with the period, they know what it is. When Aristeas is in Jerusalem, he writes letters to his friend who is still in Egypt, in Alexandria. He tells him how he's finding those 70 sages. But from our point of view, he tells us that he visited the temple. And when he describes the temple, he says an enormous structure, beautiful. Everybody admires the beauty of the temple, which is built on very solid foundation, really very strong structure. It is above everywhere. And this is really a most beautiful, fantastic thing. Moreover, he tells us that when he went out of the city and in the area which was barren, was like a desert, he hears noise of water. So he asks the people who accompany him, what is this water? So he says, this water is brought in underground channels to bring water to the temple. It was necessary for ablution, for cleansing itself, oneself before the prayer, and also to cleanse the temple mount itself. Very interesting. So already you see that in around 300 BC, already you have a description of the temple, which is completely different from the temple where people cried when they saw it. Somebody must have built a new, or to embellish, or do a lot of foundation works in order to do something like that. The most important book of the Jewish Apocrypha, which is also known in the Christian Bible, it is included in the Bible. His name is, in Hebrew, Ben Sirah. In other languages, he is called Sirach, or Sirach, or Sirace in Italian. A very famous book. It is a typical literature of wisdom, like we have in the Proverbs in the Old Testament. Very interesting. And there he says a very interesting thing. He repeats it twice. He said, should be blessed Simon, the son of John, the high priest, who like Joshua ben Yotzadak and Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel rebuild the temple in greatest care with deep foundation. He brought water to the temple, and the temple was beautiful and glorious and all that. So now we have got even the address who did it. There is a legend in Judaism, and in many legends of this type, it has a lot of truth in it. The story is that when Alexander the Great conquered the country, he did not bother to go to the mountains where Jerusalem is, because he was in our country just in order. This was the only way for the army to go to conquer Egypt. He wanted to conquer Egypt. And when he stayed overnight near the sources of one of the little rivers which flow today through Tel Aviv, in a place called Rosh Ha'ain, when he was there overnight, the high priest Simon, the son of John, came down to welcome him. And when he is coming down, Alexander Great, the great conqueror of the world, is dismounting his horse and bowing to this priest. What a surprise. So all his advisors ask him, why do you do it? Who is he? He's a small priest of a small country, because Judah was a small country, and you are bowing to him? So Alexander said, every night when I sleep before a decisive battle, this man, the vision of this man I see, and he is coming to me and telling me, tomorrow you will win the battle. This is probably a legend. But the important thing is to show that in the Hellenistic period, the relations between the people of Jerusalem were quite good. The conquest was peaceful, and therefore the Jews, as it was the fashion in all over the Hellenistic world, to rebuild the temple in a style which is very, very interesting. The style of those temples, which we see, for example, in Pergamon and other places, in around 300 BC, exactly in the same time, very interesting. You can see that the temple was standing in the middle of the mountain. The mountain could be, round like a dome, nevertheless a square structure, porticos from all around, and a beautiful gate. This style of temples will exist very, very, very late. For example, and you'll see why I say it, because such a temple, you know that when Julius Caesar became a god divine, you know that when you see the inscriptions on of structures, always Divus, Divi Augusti, Divi Julii, Divi Titi, always Divus, which means divine, God. And therefore, they built for him temples. And all the temples, till the time of Julius Caesar, until the time of Augustus, were always constructed in the same way. A temple in the middle of a courtyard, porticos from all sides. Soon you'll see why it is important for me to mention. And a beautiful gate. This is it. Now, why did I tell you all the story about the letter of Aristeas and Sirach? Because now we know that there was a third temple. The third temple was built in around 300, and it was very, very important, because to this very day, the ultra-Orthodox worship this temple. In the Talmud, when they want to describe the temple, they don't speak at all about Herod. What they speak about is this 3rd century BC temple, what I call the Hellenistic temple. And I'll tell you something very interesting. When one wants to study the history of the temple, he will always study it from two sources. One of them is the Jewish contemporary historian, Josephus Flavius, and the other one will be the Talmud. But the interesting thing is, they are completely different. You can't compare, because they're all completely different. And we understand the reason. Josephus Flavius wrote his book about the same time as the Gospels. You know, where Matthew and Luke and the others. John is a bit later. But more or less in the 80s of the first century, what he remembered was the temple of Herod. And what he describes is Herod. The Talmud describes a different temple. And for many years, there was an attempt by many who did not understand it to try and to combine how to do it, how to understand, make a combination of the two. It simply does not work. And I'll give you one example only. When the Talmud describes the temple, it says that on the western wall of the temple, there was one gate, which was called Kiponos Gate, not important. One gate. When Josephus Flavius describes the western wall, he says there were two gates. You cannot do anything. You cannot say, you know what, the middle is 2.5. Let us say that there were 2.5 gates. You see, it doesn't work that way. It's not mathematics. Especially when we know today all the four gates, which I described by Josephus Flavius, are still existing today. We'll speak about it tomorrow. And therefore, we know that he describes the Herodian Temple Mount. Now, the interesting thing is that the Talmud describes this pre-Herodian Temple Mount, the Temple Mount of the Hellenistic period. And then we'll speak about it. According to the Talmud, the dimensions of this temple was 500 cubits on 500 cubits. And remember one thing, I speak all the time, not about the temple itself, but about the Temple Mount, you know, the holy precinct, the holy enclosure in which the temple was. Is it clear? You see, completely different things. Temple and Temple Mount. The temple could not be changed. I'll tell you why. Because the dimensions of the temple are described in the Book of Kings. And no one will change the dimensions of what is written in the Old Testament. I'll tell you moreover. According to the Book of Kings, when Solomon built the temple, they say that the height of the temple was 100 cubits, about 50 meters high. Now, during the centuries, people could not, all the construction of the temple and so on was less. When Herod the Great decided to build his temple, which you see is already number four, he tried to convince the Jews that he's going to build a temple. But since the Jews hated him, and he hated the Jews, he was very bad. I wouldn't like to live under Herod. He was a great, cruel dictator. In order to convince the Jews that he has got good intentions to build a temple, he says, I know that for years the height of the temple never reached the dimension, the height which is mentioned in the Book of Kings. And what I'm going to do is to add, to bring it to be 100 cubits, exactly as the temple was. Now we are going to the story in pictures. Of course, I'll have a lot of things to say on the way. What you can see here is the eastern wall of the temple, a part of the eastern wall of the Temple Mount. We have seen already the Temple Mount as like Herodian wall. And look what happens. You have here what we call the seam, the point where two different clothes meet together. A seam, you know, is in the clothing and everything. And you see here is typical Herodian masonry, typical Herodian way of work. And on top you can see there is even a kind of a bridge. And this is more modern than what we see here. Here is an older masonry. We don't know who built it. And this is amazing because we know very well that when Herod built the temple, the 500 cubits were 500 cubits were on top of Mount Moriah. And he knew that in order to enlarge the Temple Mount, he has got to work on the north, on the west, on the south. On the east, he could not do, because down below is the valley of Kedron Valley, which separates Jerusalem from Mount of Olives, and therefore it was so steep that he could not build it. But very important for the Christians, very important. What is that? You remember I told you that he has built the temple. When it was built, the Hellenistic temple, it had porticos from four sides. Now, when Herod is building his temple, he built it from north, west, and south. And so he has to destroy the portico of the north, the portico of the west, and the portico of the south. Because otherwise, in the middle of the temple, you will have porticos which are not a part of the temple. Where didn't he have to destroy it? The eastern portico. Because there he did not add anything. So as he did this, now everybody knew that this one is older than Herod. And people attributed it to King Solomon, because they remember that Solomon was the first builder. No, it was not Solomonic, it was of the Hellenistic temple, but people did not know it. They saw an ancient one, which was different from the others, and they said this must be from the time of King Solomon. So says Josephus Flavius. He calls it Solomon Porticos. And now I come to a very important point. The name Solomon's Portico, every Christian knows. Why? Because the story is that in the Feast of Hanukkah, which is the consecration of the temple, Jesus comes out of the temple and walks under Solomon's portico. You see, those who remember the New Testament may recall it. And we know, and the Jews are coming, asking him questions and so on. Very interesting, very important, because the New Testament and Josephus Flavius agree that the Eastern portico is named Solomon's portico. You see, very, very important for us. Now again, I would like to say another thing. You know that when a Christian pilgrim is coming today to Jerusalem, he is coming to the city, he goes from one holy site to the other, but if you remember, when you read the New Testament, a lot of the events, most of the events which Jesus did in Jerusalem was in the Temple Mount. And look, a miracle The Temple Mount is not mentioned at all in the series of holy places. Why is that? Because Saladin, when he conquered Jerusalem from the Crusaders in 1187, he forbade the Christians and the Jews to go up to the Temple Mount. So when all the holy sites, so to call, in Jerusalem were created, mostly by Franciscan friars, there was no use to put holy places on the Temple Mount, which you cannot visit because you're not allowed to go to the Temple Mount. And so the Temple Mount remained outside. Now, the important for us is that we, the archaeologists, or the people who deal with holy places, what we are trying to do is to put all the sites which are described in the New Testament, all the sites, to put it on the Temple Mount of today. And remember the events which were there. When Jesus throws out of the temple the money changers, you remember, the merchants. He walks under Solomon's portico. He teaches the rabbis when he was 12 years old, he teaches the law. Yesterday I mentioned that we know where it is, on the steps leading to the Temple Mount. Those who have been yesterday may recall it. So altogether, we today were able, more or less, with great certainty, to point out, here was this and here was that. So you see, this way I'm able to speak about Solomon's portico. When you see the picture here, you may ask, if you are right in everything, that this must be the temple before Herod the Great, to which Herod had to add another part. And what you can see here is actually maybe the eastern side of the wall, on top of which was Solomon's portico. It's a real question. In order to really to fortify the idea that we have got here 3rd century, the time of the Hellenistic period, I took a picture of a site, very interesting, which is found in Sardinia, in Italy. And there you can see identical stones. Look at them. And I'm going back to the previous picture. You see the same type of stones. You see exactly the same. Here it is very well dated. Where in Jerusalem we could not date it from archaeology. But here the archaeologists who excavated this site, which is called San Antioco in Sardinia, they dated it by archaeology to the 3rd century BC. So I think that we are on a steady ground saying that this might be this. This is a part of the temple, which is the inner court, and the outer court of the temple itself with all the other installation. What you can see here is a modern reconstruction made by an artist from the description which we have on the one hand side from Ezekiel, but on the other from a very important document which I mentioned yesterday. Amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, there is one scroll which is called the Temple Scroll, which is very similar to the description we have in the book of Ezekiel. And it is so important because they are very similar, and we can see this one. Now I go further on. What we see here is a picture of the Temple Mount. Where you can see here, this is where the Dome of the Rock is. Here you can see the Holy Rock. And here you have got all the cisterns and things and so on. One of the structures, I bring this map for a simple reason. I bring it here to show you that when I speak about the temple, I'm quite on safe ground saying that the Dome of the Rock is on the site of the Holy of Holies. Why do I say that? All what you see here in color, in blue, are the underground cisterns on the Temple Mount. But we know that many of them had all kinds of functions in the temple. For example, this gate is a cistern today, but it was a gate to the temple. Here is another cistern, which was a gate to the temple. And here, this one is very, very important. Why? Because we know that in the temple, very close to the Holy of Holies, was an underground passage that when a priest who walked on the Temple Mount and suddenly he was contaminated by any reason, he had to have a tunnel, which by underground he will be taken out from the Temple Mount in order to purify himself outside the Temple Mount and then come back to the service of the temple, and so on and so forth. Now, so by seeing that, I know more or less where its location of the room where the priests were, and so I know exactly that the temple must be again under the Dome of the Rock. Now, another thing which is very important is the following one. When we have got a description of the pre-Herodian Temple Mount, we know that in the south it had two gates, which were called after the prophetess Huldah. The interesting thing is that those two, if I go back to the picture, those two gates are now cistern. One is this one, look at it, look at the shape, and this is another one. In the middle, between the two of them, is an Ottoman, not Ottoman, but Mamluk, medieval water cistern, water pond for the Muslims for ablution, to clean themselves before prayer. We now go here to the picture. You can see this Muslim structure. This is the opening to one cistern, and the opening to another cistern is here. Unfortunately, here, this one. When I took the picture, a group of Muslims were there, so I couldn't show it. But you see, both are on the same line, and so I can show more or less where the beginning, the entrance to the smaller Temple Mount, the Hellenistic Temple Mount, is there. You see, this is the shape of the two cisterns, and I can tell you, they look very much the same, and they are of great importance to us. You see, this is another picture also there. The highlight of understanding and knowing where the Temple Mount was, the pre-Herodian Temple Mount, this is a drawing made by a French artist, Lautet, in the 19th century. And suddenly, to our greatest surprise, we see here under the modern step, this is Turkish. So you see how the Temple Mount, the temple is completely, the Dome of the Rock, completely neglected. They did not care about the Temple Mount at all. But there is something very interesting. Below the steps, there is a line of steps which start here. You can see them clearer here. Can you see steps going all the way, all across the Temple Mount, on which later the Muslims built this? What are these? Now look at that. When Herod the Great, before Herod the Great built the temple, when we speak about the Hellenistic Temple Mount, every non-Jew who came to Jerusalem knew that he can walk in Jerusalem everywhere, but he is not allowed to go up to the Temple Mount. Because the worst of all crimes, I will say, in Judaism was to desecrate the Temple Mount. And to desecrate the Temple Mount or desecrate the temple was considered something which you should pay by death. It was really a lethal punishment for somebody who desecrated the temple. Very interesting. So Jew, you can never know if he desecrating the temple or not. Why? Because if everybody saw that he went to the ritual bath and he is pure and he goes up to the Temple Mount, everything is fine. He is pure, so he cannot go to the Temple Mount. No one knows if he, for one reason or the other, was contaminated. He became not pure. Whereas a non-Jew is completely sure. First of all, men are not circumcised, and the foreskin of the male is considered to be impurity. Women do not know the law of purity, the laws of purity of a woman after she is having her monthly period. She had to purify herself, and the non-Jewess did not know how to do it. So anyhow, a non-Jew is not allowed to go to the Temple Mount. If he goes, he will pay by death, even a Jew. If he is impure and he goes to the temple, he will pay by death. Now, so when the temple was a small temple before Herod the Great, there was no problem. Because everybody knows you're not pure, you're not going to the Temple Mount. But what happens when you are already, Herod built a temple, which means he extended it? How do you know where it is Herodian you can go and where it is preordained, you cannot go. So they built steps. Above it was a wall with inscription in Greek and Latin, repeating, saying a non-Jew should not pass under the penalty of death. You see, very interesting. You see, this is another picture of the period. Now you can see the steps even clearer. Can you see? These are the steps, and we believe that here where was this wall in which the inscriptions, Greek and Latin, forbidding the non-Jews to come. Those inscriptions, not, you see, this is how we understand it. This is a reconstruction. I don't exactly know how it was, but the inscriptions themselves we have. One of them, which was found in the 19th century, is now in the museum in Istanbul, because the country was under the Turks. Another fragment was found during the British rule on Palestine, and it is today in the Israel Museum, where we know exactly what those steps are, because at one point in the modern, it's a picture which I took recently, you can see one of the steps which is cut in the rock is still visible, so we know exactly the line where those inscriptions were. In other words, by having those steps and by having the inscription, we know exactly where it was. Here is actually the result of what I'm telling you. First of all, you can see here the Herodian Temple Mount. You can see it here. Down below, you can see this is the 500 cubits on 500 cubits. And here you'll see something very interesting. This is Solomon's portico. Why? Because Herod had to build all those porticos here and destroy the porticos which were around here when the pre-Herodian Temple Mount was there. Now, what is so important? Fortunately enough, the Talmud tells us that when the pre-Herodian Temple Mount was built, the largest part of the temple was in the south. Less was from here to the east, even less to the north, and the least to the west. In other words, we are able to say thanks to the location of the holiness of the temple and those steps and other things to have what it is. Now, why it is so important that I insist on telling you all those stories? Because of a very interesting thing. First of all, on the north, you can see also the limits. Suddenly, north of the 500 cubit square, which I put here, can you see? You see immediately there is a fosse. Yes, a fosse to protect the holy temple from the hill to the north. You understand? So I know that it cannot go beyond that. So it helps me to limit the whole thing. Now, why is it so important to us? If you remember, in the book of Acts, Paul is coming with two Greek, non-Jewish Greeks. Anybody remembers it? So all the Jews are very angry. How can you bring the Greeks into the temple? And everybody is shouting at him. And they tell him, take out those people to their court. To their court, which means what we call the court of the Gentile. It appears only in the New Testament, in no Jewish source. In other words, I can explain as follows. When I take the 500 cubits on 500 cubits, the pre-Herodian Temple Mount, and I put it on the hill of Moriah, on Mount Moriah, it occupies exactly Mount Moriah. You understand? When Herod the Great extends, he goes beyond Mount Moriah, he fills in valleys around it, he cuts the mountain in the north, and so actually his area of the temple is beyond Mount Moriah. And therefore it is not considered holy. You understand? So we've got the holy part and the non-holy. And therefore the Gentiles could go in the area which was on the Herodian part. So I can make an equation. The Herodian part is a Gentile court, and it is outside of the Hellenistic temple. You understand? And that's how I can do it. It is of great, great importance. Today, when observant Jews are coming to the Temple Mount, they know that they can walk only on the part which is Herodian, But they cannot go to the part which is the 500 cubits on 500 cubits. So since they don't know what the size of the cubit is, according to them, I'm sure I know, they refrain from going up to the Temple Mount, which is very interesting. In the north, you see, in the excavations, we have found remains of walls, which may be the citadel, which was north of the Temple Mount. So we know that, again, it is outside the holiness. Here you can see the Greek version of the inscriptions which forbid the Gentile from trespassing. Those who can read in Greek will see that the last word here is Theta Alpha Thanaton, or Thanatos. What is Thanatos? Death. You see, this is a punishment for those who trespass. So this inscription is in Istanbul. Unfortunately, they put it on the side. It's not so visible. But for us, the Jewish people, it's extremely important, because this is as if a letter directly from the temple of Herod the Great. Very nice. And this is the temple, how it is reconstructed, Herod's temple. Well, you can imagine that the great part of it, you don't see actually, you don't see where the limits were. Because Herod had to remove all the remains, all the porticos which were there. So here I did, you know, I took a map, a drawing of Jerusalem, aerial photograph of Jerusalem, and I made, you see, in green, all the limits of the 500 cubits, you see like this. The Dome of the Rock is here, not in the center, and so actually the Gentiles' court will be here. You see, I marked here the valleys, which I know it cannot go beyond, and so actually here is where the steps are. So altogether, that's how we could make it. But this is not the end of the story. This is the typical reconstruction of the temple. You see, square, not like it is today, Herodian, and so on and so forth. Here I brought another picture which shows you Jerusalem in the Second Temple period, where you can see here, you can see the temple as it is today, and inside you can see the 500 cubits on 500 cubits. This is not the end, although the slides end, I want to go on. It's not a simple thing to stop here. The temple was destroyed. So first of all, first temple by Solomon, second temple by Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Yeshua ben Yotzadak. The third temple was built by Simon the high priest, and the fourth temple built by Herod. So those who want to see another temple have to look for the fifth one. But now I'm going on. And this is very important, which I think I should tell you. We know that, you know, the revolt against the Romans ended in 70 with the destruction of the temple. 60 years later, another revolt starts, the Bar Kokhba revolt, the second revolt, which was even rougher than the first revolt. As a result, Hadrian built Jerusalem as a pagan city named Aelia Capitolina. And here comes the great problems, and immediately you'll understand why I mention it. When Hadrian built it, he built it to the deities of Jerusalem, because the city was called Aelia Capitolina. Aelius was a private name of Hadrian, whose full name was Publius Aelius Hadrianus, and Capitolina because of the triad of the capital, Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva. In the 3rd century, a Roman historian named Cassius Dio tells us that instead of the Jewish temple, Hadrian built a temple to Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva. Because of the saying of this 3rd century historian, Cassius Dio, everybody said that on the Temple Mount was built a temple to Jupiter. And this is so clear that you can see it in old maps and everywhere, the temple of Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva, on the Temple Mount. The problem is, or rather, a Dominican father, J. Murphy O'Connor, he said, yes, this historian is right. Instead of the Jewish temple as a focus of sanctity and holiness in Jerusalem, Emperor Hadrian built a temple to Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva, which means not geographically on the same place, but as a concept of focus of holiness in Jerusalem. Why do I mention that? Because we have the church fathers. We've got, first of all, Eusebius, but the most important of all is Saint Jerome, Hieronymus, Holy Hieronymus. And they all tell us a very interesting story. Already the Christian community of Jerusalem started to worship the tomb of Jesus and the hill of Golgotha. And since Emperor Hadrian wanted to reunify the Roman Empire, the way to do it was, first of all, to unify religion. And therefore, he said, the religion of the Roman Empire will be the Greek religion. All those who are not Greek by religion, they are criminals. So he took the Christians and started real persecution against the Christians. Twice in the history of Rome, it happened. Because the same story of reunification of the Roman Empire happened also in the days of Diocletian, around 300 AD. So if you remember, when you read about all the martyrs, the most important, the early martyrs of the Christian church, they are either under Hadrian or under Diocletian. Am I right or not? You see, the story is, therefore, that in order to prevent the Christians from coming to pray on the site of the tomb of Jesus or the hill of Golgotha, he covered it all and built a temple on the site where the tomb of Jesus was. You understand? Very interesting. And therefore, all the writers who saw how Constantine the Great built the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, what do they say? That he, the first thing to do, he removed all the soil which was accumulated by Hadrian in order to cover the Christian holy places. He reduced it, and so the tomb of Jesus was discovered. So was discovered the tomb of Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea. So was discovered the hill of Golgotha, and all was done when Constantine reduced it. In other words, for a long time, all through the Roman period, Temple Mount remained empty. And it was very, very good to the Christians. Why? Because the fact that the Temple Mount was empty is complying with the story of Jesus, that not one stone over the other will remain. And you see, the proof is no stone of the temple on the other is remained. And on this background only, you can understand how the Jews were happy when the Muslims come to Jerusalem, allow the Jews to come to Jerusalem, and they built on the site of the temple, they built the Dome of the Rock to shelter the holy rock, which was the base to the Holy of Holies. So this is the history of the Mount. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Another punishment.